Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
I'm Zatanna. Why do you care about some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Welcome back to Power Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Daly, and today, after so long, I am picking up my coverage of Black Canary's backup stories from the World's Finest Comics Dollar Era. If you listened to the last two episodes of the show, you heard replays of Flowers and Fishnets, which was the Black Canary show that preceded this one, episodes 10 and 11. On those episodes, I talked about Black Canary and Green Arrow's stories from World's Finest issues 244 and 245. If you know how numbers work, you should figure out that this episode will feature the Blonde Bombshell and Emerald Archer stories from World's Finest 246. And that is all I have for preamble. Let's skip over the first promo break and get right to our first story starring Black Canary.
Werewolf!
Werewolf?
Yeah. What? Werewolf. There, Castle.
Why are you talking that way?
I thought you wanted to.
No, I don't want to.
Suit yourself. I'm easy.
Wolf Hunt, that's W-U-L-F, is written by Jerry Conway, penciled by Mike Nasser, also known as Mike Netzer, and inked by Terry Austin. This story, like the rest of the issue, was edited by Denny O'Neill. While skimming a newspaper for job listings, Dinah Drake Lance finds an article about a mysterious occurrence in Queens Ridge, British Columbia. Members of the McIntosh Lumber Camp had been hearing wolf howls for a while. A lumberjack named Pierre Dubois went off into the woods with an axe to investigate the sounds. Pierre disappeared. His body was found days later, horribly eviscerated. Paw prints found near the body indicated a wolf of enormous size. This fed rumors that Pierre Dubois may have been the victim of some kind of werewolf. Dinah puts her job search on hold to investigate this mystery in Canada. After her encounter with the man-bear last issue, there might be a connection to this rumored werewolf. Soon after arriving in Queens Ridge, Dinah, now in the blonde wig and fishnet garb of Black Canary, scouts the land and finds a group of drunken lumberjacks carrying axes and guns. The men have cornered a wolf and her cubs. Black Canary sneaks up on the men, leaps down, and tackles the gunman before he can shoot the wolf. The lumberjacks, not just drunk now, but angry too, threaten to shoot Black Canary. She uses her canary cry to destroy their rifles. That sobers them up quick, and the men apologize for attacking Black Canary. She asks them what they were doing, and they admit that after their friend Pierre was killed, they wanted revenge, so they came out hunting for any wolf they could find. Black Canary stopped them from killing the mother and her cubs, who escaped into the woods during Canary's intervention. The lumberjacks tell Black Canary that Pierre wasn't the first victim of the giant wolf. The leader of the lumberjacks says the wolves around Queens Ridge are killers, no matter what Black Canary or the professor say. She asks what professor they're talking about. One of the guys says a professor named Dr. Grant, who advocates for animal rights, lives in a cabin on the mountain. Black Canary heads out to talk to this professor, but the lumberjacks don't like that. They've got some secrets they don't want her uncovering, so they follow her. Black Canary climbs the mountain to Dr. Grant's cabin. When she arrives, she finds Grant dead, murdered. Not by a wolf, clearly, but by a gunshot. The cabin was ransacked. Dinah finds a casebook on the floor and flips through it, looking for answers. She reads the professor's report of genetic experimentation on a wolf, increasing the animal's intelligence as well as its size. Dinah confirms her suspicions that the same professor created the man-bear Ursus seen last issue as an early attempt at genetic manipulation, before perfecting his experiment on the wolf. And all of these experiments were done for some mysterious financier. According to Grant's casebook, he thought wolf, with a U, was the perfect hybrid of man's intellect and beast's physicality. One night, wolf slipped away from the cabin. Dr. Grant followed and saw his creation try to join a wolf pack. Wolf wanted the social experience, but the real wolves rejected him and attacked. This confirmed Grant's theory that his creation was more than just a bigger, smarter wolf, but a new species. When the journal cuts off abruptly, Black Canary wonders if the same financier responsible for Man-Bear and Wolf killed Dr. Grant to learn the secrets of these Annie-men. Then she hears a creak behind her and sees the lumberjack sneaking up on her with an axe. She drops low, swings her leg out, and trips the Axeman, then smashes his jaw with her fist. Just as effortlessly, she takes out a second assailant. The third man surrenders quickly and offers up answers to Black Canary's questions. The lumberjacks admit they roughed up Dr. Grant when he first came to the mountain, but they had nothing to do with his death. They found his body days ago and were afraid that they'd be blamed for killing him, so they didn't report it. Canary is disgusted that grown men would react to the professor with the same hostility that the Wolf Pack did to Wolf. That night, Dinah calls her boyfriend Oliver Queen from her hotel room. She thinks Wolf killed Pierre Dubois, but doesn't know who killed Grant or who funded his projects to make these Annie men. Ollie offers to come up to Canada to help her out, but she says that she's got it covered. Dinah doesn't realize that Wolf is outside her hotel room, watching her. She goes to the bathroom, strips naked, and gets into the shower, not realizing the giant wolf right outside her door. The story ends on the classic horror cliffhanger with a tag for next issue, Requiem of Rage. After last issue saw Black Canary facing the Man-Bear, it's a little odd that she's chasing a werewolf in this issue. I mean, there is a narrative logic to it that Jerry Conway constructs. The two hybrid creatures were made by the same scientist. This is part of a larger story that Conway is telling over multiple issues. But the two things that just feel a little bit odd about it are, number one, Ursus the Man-Bear from World's Finest 245 and Wolf the Werewolf from this issue aren't visually that distinct. I know someone with a lot of knowledge of animals will tell me bears and wolves are nothing alike, but the thing is, for the purposes of this superhero adventure story, they really are similar. Bear and wolf, both fur-covered predators with powerful teeth and claws and reputations for savagery, plus you give them a humanoid bipedal form and they both look pretty much like classic werewolf-type creatures. It's just a little strange that we'd get two different creatures, two different characters, that look and act almost identical to each other in back-to-back stories. And number two of what makes this story odd is its place in a Black Canary story. I have talked before about Canary's rogues gallery and how sparse it is. World's Finest 244 did a great job of putting her against characters like the Rainbow Archer and Slingshot. But now, two stories in a row, Dinah's threatened by Man-Bear and Wolf. Great villains stick around because they have a good motif, a good design, and usually some kind of thematic connection to the hero. Black Canary is a sexy private investigator slash martial arts master. Why is she fighting genetically engineered human-animal hybrid monsters? These are the kinds of enemies you throw up against Hawkman and Hawkgirl, or Wonder Woman, or even Green Arrow, because at least he has the hunter motif and the forest slash jungle connection. This is an atypical antagonist for a character like Black Canary, which doesn't have to be a problem, except, again, two very similar types of monsters in back-to-back stories, and this story isn't even over yet. We've got more of the werewolf next issue, so it's not bad, it's just kind of odd, I think. Aside from that, though, the story is fine. There isn't much going on, but I do like that Black Canary beats up the same group of lumberjacks twice. We don't see what happens to them at the end of the story, but I'm assuming she had them arrested for failing to report a dead body. Also, they tried to kill her with an axe at least twice. There's also a bit of commentary from Conway about these rural lumberjacks' anti-intellectual attitudes towards a scientist. Dinah compares them to animals rejecting something that looks or seems a little different. The analogy feels extremely relevant today when it seems like the poorly educated are more skeptical, if not downright resentful, of science and education more than ever. I guess it's up to our government and the Department of Education to ensure that our schools produce critical thinkers and... well, it was a nice thought. Mike Nasser, or Netzer's art looks good, though it doesn't stand out quite as much as in previous stories. He gives Dinah a few good panels where she's kicking or punching the guys, but the details look a bit thin. Maybe rushed is all I can think. I really shouldn't complain, though, since he does draw Dinah taking her clothes off and jumping into the shower in the last page. It's a sexy finish, though coupled with the danger of the werewolf lurking out the window, pretty classic horror monster or slasher movie climax. Kudos to Conway, Nasser, and Austin for that. The only problem is my copy of the issue has a misprint or color defect on that page. There's a red splotch on the last panel that runs across Dinah's naked torso that can't help but look like blood she's about to wash off. And given the context, it kind of takes away from the sexiness. Oh, well. We will see where this shower scene goes in World's Finest, issue 247, to be reviewed on a future episode of this podcast. But for now, I'm going to take a promo break, and then I'll be back to talk about what Green Arrow was up to while Dinah went to Canada. Stick around.
Hey, Kids Comics!
Hey, Michael!
Yeah?
We need to do a new promo.
A new one?
A new one.
Why?
Because we've moved.
Moved?
Moved. We've moved to a new place. We still read comics.
We do. We still talk about comics.
Because you can't do a comic book podcast unless you read and talk about comics, because that's kind of stupid. But now, we have a new episode still available every Thursday, but at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com.
Hey Kids Comics!
So remember, Hey Kids Comics has moved to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Still, every Thursday. That'll do, won't it?
The Green Arrow story in World's Finest 246 is titled Manhunt for a Murderer, and is brought to us by the same creative team of Jerry Conway, Mike Nasser, and Terry Austin. In Star City, crime boss Barney Breed calls Slingshot to his hideout to scold him for failing to destroy mayoral candidate Whitney Spencer, and for drawing the attention of Black Canary and Green Arrow. See World's Finest issue 244 and or Power of Fishnets episode 16 for details. Suddenly, Green Arrow crashes through the window, bow and arrow drawn back, ready for action. The Emerald Archer fires a gas arrow into the wall. It explodes, releasing a tranquilizer gas into the room. Ollie fights two of Breed's underlings while the boss passes out from the gas. Meanwhile, Slingshot manages to slip out the door. Green Arrow runs out into the hall to chase Slingshot, but the villain has already escaped. So as not to be a total failure, though, Ollie takes the doorknob from Breed's office, the doorknob covered in Slingshot's fingerprints. Green Arrow takes the doorknob to the FBI field office in Star City, where the prints are matched to a convict named David Drayson. The local newspaper editor, Mr. Taylor, tells the Archer all about Drayson, claiming he was a crazy man who saw the police as a symbol of persecution, and later went to jail for murdering a cop. In the ghetto of Star City known as the Swamp, Slingshot meets with a gang of street toughs. The Hoods are upset that Slingshot is bringing unwanted heat down on them, but Slingshot lashes out at two of the crybabies, taking them down with his signature sling and stone. After this display, the other Hoods agree to fall in line. Green Arrow rides a traffic helicopter over the Swamp and drops down on the neighborhood where Slingshot grew up. Ollie tracks Slingshot to his hideout and overhears the villain and his Hoods planning to take down a Numbers outfit. Green Arrow fires a concussion arrow inside the hideout, but Slingshot happened to be behind the refrigerator door just as the arrow goes off, sparing him the brunt of the concussive blast. When Green Arrow jumps in the apartment, Slingshot throws a stone that knocks him out. The cops arrive and wake Green Arrow, and after conferring about Slingshot's plan, one of the cops tells him the target is probably Numbers racketeer Reggie Ronson. Right about the same time, Slingshot goes to Ronson demanding money from his outfit. Ronson's goons threaten Slingshot, but he takes them down with his super Slingshot powers, patent pending. He then scares Ronson into giving him $500,000. As Slingshot starts to run away, the cop car with Green Arrow riding shotgun pulls up in front of him. Slingshot flashes back to that fateful day when he murdered a cop. History almost repeats as he hurls a stone at the police officer driver, but Green Arrow pushes the cop out of the way, saving his life. Slingshot makes a run for it. Green Arrow draws back his bow, but it's no trick arrow he lets fly this time. He shoots a regular tipped arrow that flies through the air and rips through Slingshot's shoulder, dropping the villain to the street in agony. As Green Arrow and the cop drag Slingshot to the police cruiser, Ollie feels a sense of pride that he didn't rely on any trick arrows this time. I like that Jerry Conway picked up Slingshot, who Tony Isabella created in World's Finest 244, but I have to admit I much prefer the way Isabella wrote the character to the Slingshot in this issue. In the climactic face-off in the courthouse of the previous issue, Isabella hinted at a darker past for Slingshot, where maybe he was the victim of tragic circumstances that led him to his criminal career. Here, Conway uses Mr. Taylor to make a clear moral judgment of the character. He says Drayson was clearly psychotic. He has a clear persecution complex, and he takes it out on the police. It's hard to feel any type of sympathy for Slingshot now, which isn't wholly necessary. Not every supervillain needs the pathos of Mr. Freeze from Batman the Animated Series. Trust me, I'm okay with the bad guys just being bad guys because they're bad guys most of the time. But in this case, it clearly seemed like Isabella had more of a sympathetic background in mind for the character that Jerry Conway just chose to ignore or oversimplify, and that kind of bothers me. It would be like hinting at this elaborate love story for Mr. Freeze, only to reveal that Nora was a figment of his imagination and he was a psycho all along. Oh wait, yeah, they actually did that in the New 52. Jackasses. Anyway, aside from the... Well, this will sound harsh, but I feel like his characterization was slightly bastardized this time around. But aside from that, I still love Slingshot. I love his gimmick and his look. I made a case 2 episodes ago that he should be a bigger villain in Green Arrow's universe. The Slingshot is a great, simple, ranged weapon, and his costume is distinct, though I don't think the printing and coloring quality on this issue does many favors for the brown and bronze scheme. The last 2 points about this issue I want to make are, I like how, in the moment when Ollie fires the concussion arrow into the room, Slingshot is spared because he just so happens to be opening the refrigerator door at that moment. This is the kind of thing that could be seen as a cheat, and it could have been handled that way. But Conway is better than that, and it's basically so absurd, so mundane, so casual, that it comes off as perfectly realistic and believable. When you're watching a movie and there's a sniper with a target in his crosshairs and something blocks the shot at the last minute, that often feels like Deus Ex Machina. But in this case, Green Arrow is spying on Slingshot, but he needs to take his eyes off the target for a minute to draw back his arrow and shoot. It is allowable and therefore acceptable that in that moment when his eyes are off the target steps out of position and opens the fridge. It's a good moment. The other thing I like is how Green Arrow becomes so friendly with this uniformed cop who I don't think we ever get a name for in the story. The uniformed officer plays a nice little function of exposition, transportation, and rescuee by the end of the story. But it's just great seeing Ollie pal around with this blue-collar cop. It reminds us of a time when heroes were crime fighters, not vigilantes. Alrighty, we're going to take another promo break now, and then we'll be back with listener feedback.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Hi, I'm Tim from Cord Industries, the Blue Beetle blog. I'm here to tell you about an exciting new addition to the Silver and Gold family of podcasts. The show is Beatlemania, and it focuses on what is arguably one of the greatest superheroes in all of comics history, Blue Beetle. From the adventures of Dan Garrett the cop in the 1930s to Dan Garrett the archaeologist in the 1960s, from everyone's favorite Ted Kord to the more recent adventures of Jaime Reyes, we'll be covering the entire legacy of the Blue Beetle, and I won't be doing it alone. Joining me for this epic journey through the lives of the Blue Beetle will be Jay from the Silver and Gold Podcast. Together, we'll be discussing, reviewing, and celebrating the awesomeness of all of the Beatles. Beatlemania, coming soon to sngpod.com and cordindustries.blogspot.com.
Last episode covered Zatanna's appearance in Justice League of America 87, as well as Black Canary and Green Arrow strips from World's Finest 245. The episode received Twitter favorites and retweets from Ange, Austin Cookendall, Bat at Shapirak, Between the Pages, Bill Bearer, Birds of Prey Podcast, BoldOutloud.com, Cindy Womack, Coffee and Comics, Comic Reflections, Comics in the Golden Age, David Ace Gutierrez, DCU Movie Page, Ed Moore, Ed Moore, Ed Moore, and Ed Moore Jr., Inigo Montoya, Gabriel M. Cox, Hicks at Reading_Hicks, Jacob Edwards, Joe Montenegro, Keith G. Baker, Martin Gray, Mike Alavarisi, Pod Dylan, RAD Adventures, Relatively Geeky, Robin Goschel, Rolled Spine Podcast, Siskoid, Tom Keller, Treasury Comics, Unearthly Visions, The Watcher, 92-241, Wild Dog Podcast, Willie Yarbrough, Xenozoic Xenophiles, Zoom Yukinori, and Zach at Zach is Batman. Facebook likes and shares came from Billy Lacoste, Chris Franklin, Cosmic Cat Comics, David Foster, Gene Hendricks, Gore Tolton, Grant Richter, H. Daniel Reibolt, Jared West, Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, Kal-El Commandy, Rob Kelly, Scott Cage, Scott Rowland, Sean Emmons, Sean Strawbridge, Shag, Siskoid, Van Z, and Zoom Yukinori. Moving on to the comments on the Fire and Water website, which you can read at fireandwaterpodcast.com, and while you're there, why not leave a comment of your own and get in on this sweet feedback action? First comment came from my best friend Chris Franklin, host of the Supermates podcast, co-host of Power Records, and my partner on Batman Nightcast. Chris said, I've heard of this Justice League story for years, but I had no idea how strange it was. I honestly didn't even know Zatanna appeared in it. I think someone needs to ask Mike Friedrich about Zatanna. I've interviewed him for Back Issue, and he's a super nice guy and very responsive. It wouldn't surprise me that he wanted Zatanna in the League. He's obviously very fond of her. But yeah, there are some weird Justice League stories. Fox wrote some, O'Neill wrote some, but this may be the strangest one I've heard of. Although the retconning of Black Canary into her own daughter, which we covered, Ryan, is almost just as nuts. That is true. The story from Justice League of America 219 and 220 that Chris and I reviewed way back on Flowers and Fishnets, where Roy Thomas retconned Black Canary to be her own daughter, that was a weird one. But that was a well-crafted story with a really bizarre twist at the end. Issue 87, on the other hand, goes off the rails on page 5, then jumps several tracks, then turns into a boat. It's just nonsensical. My best friend Rob Kelly from Treasury Cast, Pod Dylan, Fire and Water, Film and Water, Who's Who, Power Records, and Digest Cast said of the Black Canary story from World's Finest, "I remember distinctly that panel of a topless Dinah, and it made quite an impression on my then young mind. Was the Comics Code Authority flunky assigned to this story looking out the window when he was going over this page? I assume having to look at thousands of pages of Richie Rich comics would dull the senses, so sometimes stuff slipped by, and thank Rao for that." Then Rob said, "As mean as it might sound, I really can't wait to hear what this show sounds like once Roy Thomas Daly arrives. Note, that will not be my son's name. I picture lots of slurred words and 10,000-foot level story recaps owing to lack of sleep." So, Dinah Shore kicks a guy, and then Green Lantern makes chili, and just wait, my friend, that may be exactly what the show turns into. And Rob ended his comment with his customary "F*** Steve Bannon" so that I can read it aloud on the episode, as is customary. F*** Mitch McConnell, too. My best friend Alan Wright talked about Zatanna not joining the Justice League at an earlier time and speculated that it may have had to do with Denny O'Neil not really feeling comfortable with her power set. And it's an interesting thought. O'Neil shined when writing powerless heroes like Batman and Green Arrow. He depowered Wonder Woman and hardly ever used Black Canary's Sonic Scream. Maybe he could never wrap his head around Zatanna and her magic powers. I don't know. Then Alan said, "I also enjoyed the rerun of the World's Finest appearances, too. I wonder who we were supposed to side with in the Green Arrow-Black Canary arguments. Looking back on it, Green Arrow is a sexist, boorish jackass in the issue, and Black Canary is right to call him on it. But I think at the time, Ollie's chauvinistic attitudes could still be considered normal. I know in later issues, Dinah apologizes for going a little too far in snapping at Ollie, though. Part of it feels like course correction for the submissiveness we saw from Dinah in previous depictions. I know many people love that. Oliver, I can't be sure, and I don't know why, but I think I love you," from Action Comics 428. But she seemed too passive to me. Not everything Conway does holds up to scrutiny 40 years later, but I think he was at least attempting to increase the power and dignity of Black Canary. Well, better late than never. Better something than nothing. She's still in Green Arrow's shadow, though, so I don't know. My best friend Martin Gray from the blog Too Dangerous for a Girl said, "Splendid show as ever, but what a stupid story. I've never read the first appearance of the Champions of Angor and assumed they were the main event, but no, it was Batman with a bat crown and bat scepter. Awesome. That panel of Zatanna, the bearer of peace, is utterly bizarre, and setting up the story's final panel is no excuse. Wasn't Julie Schwartz an extremely hands-on editor who insisted on tight plots? Maybe this was a DC Universe version of Assistant Editor's Month. Then again, that would have left E. Nelson Bridwell in charge, and he'd never have signed off on this one." Then Martin speculated, "Could it be that Schwartz wouldn't let Z join the team back then because it was subtitled The World's Greatest Superheroes, and she didn't have a regular strip?" I gave that some thought, but at this point in the publishing history of Justice League of America, I can't imagine that mattered. The Atom and Hawkman were no longer appearing in their own books, and Black Canary hadn't had her own solo strip since 1949. She had been appearing in some, not all, but just some, of the annual JLA-JSA crossovers when she was brought over from Earth 2 and pegged as Wonder Woman's replacement, so I don't think that reason holds up. My best friend David Ace Gutierrez said, "This was the Nasser Netzer art that made me love Black Canary." Good comment, Dave. Short and to the point. Love it. The Irredeemable Shag from Justice League of America Bwahaha podcast knows a thing or two about the Champions of Angor, because back on episode 2 of the Bwahaha podcast, Shag and Michael Bailey covered Justice League issue 2, which saw the Champions return to face off against the post-Crisis League. Anyway, Shag offered some possible explanations for this crazy story. One, often an editor would commission a cover and ask the writer to then write a story about it. That might have been Friedrich's charge. If so, that would explain why King Batman is so quickly wedged in and then ignored. Two, Friedrich spent so much time building to the pseudo-Avengers, but then only gave them a few pages. Maybe he tried to slip it past his editors by just doing it a few pages? Or he was too busy explaining the King Batman nonsense he couldn't get to the pseudo-Avengers quick enough? And three, Friedrich has a serious no draw for Zatanna. And in case you don't know what Shag meant by no draw, say it backwards like Zatanna would. And our final comment came from my best friend Zumyuki Nori, who supported Shag's idea that the Mad King Batman story was probably forced because the cover by Neil Adams had been commissioned first. This was a common occurrence throughout the Silver Age. Zoom then said, as I relook at the panel of Black Canary stripping off her strapless and sleeveless bustier top, I couldn't help but notice her wrists, which seem to be slipped through holes that are actually not supposed to be there. I wonder why I had never noticed that before. Zoom clarified that the last question was rhetorical, but the thing is, I noticed that recently too. I was trying to figure out what part of her costume is wrapped around her wrist, and my mind couldn't make sense of it. Of course, then I stopped caring that much and focused on the rest of her body. Anyway, back to Zoom's comment. To be further pedantic, my understanding is that Zatanna's backward spells should be pronounced reverse phonetically. In other words, the hypothetical spell for Superman would be Ud-Im, and your sign-off, Va-Assign-Yade, correct? Maybe? I've never heard if there is an exact rule for how her spells are supposed to sound out loud. The only time I've ever heard them is on Justice League Unlimited, where sometimes they sounded reverse phonetic, and sometimes I didn't think they sounded like that, so I just kind of figured Andrea Romano went with whatever sounded best. My approach to reading her spells has always been to try and capture the letters, the text, because that's what's printed. And maybe I'm way off on that, and maybe that's not how it's supposed to be, but I've never heard definitively otherwise. So, anyway, that is going to be all for this episode of Power of Fishnets. I want to thank all of my listeners who wrote in and left comments, everybody who promoted the show on social media, Facebook and Twitter. Please keep it up. I love this feedback, and it really helps the show, and I do appreciate this interaction. Next episode, we look at the next chronological appearance of Zatanna, which happened to be a small, very small part in World's Finest issue 207. But rather than just gloss over it for the sake of expediency, I'm doing like the opposite of that and spending the episode talking about Superman and Batman with a special guest. All right, talk to you again in 2 or 3 weeks, maybe? Power of Fishnets is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com or the Power of Fishnets Facebook page. You can also find me on Twitter at RyanDaily01, or you can send an email to rdailypodcast@gmail.com. Power of Fishnets is not affiliated with DC Comics, and the views expressed in the show belong solely to the speaker. All music, audio clips, and quoted text are used for entertainment purposes and believed covered under fair use. Since I make no money off this podcast, no copyright infringement is intended. Thanks for listening, and Iva Aisin Yad. Or if you prefer, Va Asin Yad. In touch with the ground, I'm on the-